This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, this is Katia Rogers, executive producer of On the Media. This holiday week, we're featuring a series of conversations about an alarming loss of trust, faith, and devotion by Americans for American democracy. This miniseries is part of a month-long campaign called the Purple Project for Democracy, a strictly nonpartisan, apolitical effort. Our very own Bob Garfield is one of the Purple Project organizers. We recommend that you listen to this series in order. This is episode one, in which Bob explores whether our form of government truly is up for grabs.
Democracy is in trouble, not necessarily because of our current political mayhem or even because of the accumulated sins and failures of American society, but because vast swaths of the public are giving up on the system that has governed us for 243 years. Here are some alarming data points. One, in 2018, only 33% of the general population expressed trust for government. Two, in another survey among 1,400 adults asked about the importance of democracy, only 39% of younger participants said absolutely important. Three, in a 2018 Democracy Fund survey of 5,000 Americans, 24% of respondents expressed support for a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress or elections, and 18% for army rule. Of course, 18% of Americans believe in alien abductions, and there is still overriding majority support for democracy across all polling. But the expressions of disaffection are growing, and the metrics of trust are plummeting. The question is, what as a society we are to do about it, and who exactly will be doing the doing? Will it be the schools? Will it be civil society? Will it be membership and fraternal organizations like the Boy Scouts, AARP, and the Rotary Club? Will it be political leaders? And not incidentally, will it be the media? In this miniseries, we'll be talking that over, but we'll begin with the actual state of public sentiment and public participation. Eric Liu is the co-founder and CEO of Citizen University and co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on the Practice of Democratic Citizenship. A two-year survey of American sentiments and civic participation meant to suggest solutions for widespread disaffection. Eric, welcome to On the Media.
So good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right. I described those various data points as alarming. Am I just being, you know, alarmist?
I don't think you are. I think the body politic is sick. Democracy works only if enough of us believe democracy works. And that's not a tautology. That is actually a statement of the fragile mutual agreement that has to unfold, you know, many millions of times over for us to actually sustain a sense that this system is legitimate enough to not quit on it. And in normal times, we don't even notice that million-fold mutual agreement. But in abnormal times like today, when you start sensing it evaporating, you realize just how fragile it is to sustain that sense of what I think of as civic faith.
Your Blue Ribbon Commission on the Practice of Democratic Citizenship has been documenting the trajectory of public sentiment for more than a year now. And I know its report won't be issued till May. But there are preliminary findings, some having to do with propaganda, some with the lack of civics education, some having to do with filter bubbles and social media, some having to do just with our current political chaos. Is that a good short list of root causes for disaffection?
I think there's another big one that I would add, and that is, of course, the tectonic levels of inequality and concentration of wealth that have unfolded in the United States and actually in other societies around the world over the last generation. And when you get that kind of clumping and hoarding of voice and money and clout and political power, you get the kind of fragility that you see in our political system. You get people on both the left and the right who are angry and populist in their willingness to burn down the system and to mistrust experts of any stripe just to delegitimize the whole endeavor, because in many ways, the whole endeavor has not delivered for them. And so when you look at the ways in which, you know, Russia, for instance, is deploying bots to exploit our divisions, yes, that's a malevolent set of acts, but they would have just bounced right off us had we had a healthy body politic, had the immune system of the body politic been strong enough to resist these viral efforts to exploit our divisions and our fears and our anxieties.
So when we look for who or what to blame, we can't ignore actual failure and betrayal, whether the economic inequality and injustice that you described or countless other sins and slights and scandals and surrenders from the original sin of slavery straight through. The frustration isn't just imagined, right? In many ways, left or right, democracy has just plain disappointed.
Well, I think that's right. And what democracy has compounded is this market fundamentalism and this hyper-individualism in this globalized, tech-fueled economic age that has made it more possible culturally, ethically, morally, to pretend that it's truly every man or woman for themselves. The way that democracy has become a handmaiden to this market imperialism right now is what has left so many people so cynical. What we have to think about how we can take responsibility for things is asking, how do we create a sense of invitation back into a public sphere that does not feel like a sucker's game? Does not feel like a thing, hey, come on in here so that you can be taken advantage of again.
Withdrawing from civic life is a perhaps rational response to legitimate grievance. But, geez, you know, even during the thick of the Vietnam War, which was simultaneous with civil rights protests around the country in the 60s, there was no broad sentiment for ditching democracy or abandoning the government. Trust in the system of government, at least according to tracking polls at the time, remained quite high. What has changed?
One of the things that is driving this loss of faith in democracy is this depth of inequality. During the Vietnam era, the economy was still growing robustly and prosperity was much more widely shared than the prosperity of, say, the last decade since the Great Recession. When you think about the ways in which over 90% of the gains of the, quote, recovery from the Great Recession and the financial collapse have accrued to the very top 1 and 10% of Americans, you don't have a feeling that we're all in it together. You don't have a feeling that a rising tide will lift all boats. You have a feeling that a rising tide is going to leave me beached. So that's one of the big shifts. The other thing that has changed, you know, when you ask the question, you know, why is it that even in that period of crisis 50 years ago, people still maintain faith in democracy? Part of the reason, if I may be honest, is that the public square back then was still predominantly white and relatively privileged. And we now have a far more inclusive public square. We have now far wider dispersion of expectations of inclusion among people who 50, 75 years ago just knew right off the bat they weren't going to be included. Eric Liu was not getting interviewed on national public radio shows 50 years ago to talk about the state of democracy in the United States.
The commission isn't just collating survey data. You are hitting the hustings, talking to Americans, you know, border to border, coast to coast about the state of the society and their sentiments. Is there anything that's jumped out at you, perhaps especially salient or just unexpected from the interviews that you're conducting?
Of course, all of our attention is being sucked up by the psychodrama of what's going on in national politics right now in D.C. But in communities around the country, there are people trying to re-rig rules. They're trying to include people who've been excluded, whether by race, by ex-felon status, by class, in other ways, to reincorporate them into civic life and decision-making. There are efforts to just renew that faith in democracy that isn't about blind exhortation, but is about creating opportunities for people to serve together, try to solve problems together. That story that is emerging from the bottom up in towns across America is undertold, in my view. And in our work as a commission, we have seen and heard a lot of that and heard kind of a plea from people we've spoken with and spent time with. Please make this part of the story, not only because it's true and we feel underheard in Kansas City or San Bernardino or Akron or Brownsville, Minnesota, or wherever it might be, but also because we need to have that narrative out so that it itself can become contagious, so that people can realize that all hope is not lost, and that even as things sink more deeply into crisis in D.C., that we, the people, retain a capacity for renewal and responsibility, both at the local level, but in a way that is networks to other people working at a local level. And that's what's different today compared to, say, 50, 75 years ago, is just the webbing that is possible of these kinds of bottom-up efforts.
It's funny that you mentioned San Bernardino, because that's one of the key locations for Deb and Jim Fallows in their book, where they went to find democracy working and located it in about 98% of America, including their hometown of San Bernardino, California. It's easy to be distracted and become dispirited by what happens inside the Beltway or in state capitals. But if you want to see democracy work, why, go to your city council. Most likely, it's doing its job just fine right there.
Let's be honest. There are plenty of places where it's not. But it is still far more possible where it's not working to re-rig the game, to insert yourself into the map of power, to rewrite that map by showing up, by organizing people and ideas and attention in a way that is far more palpable and achievable at the level of your town, your county, your neighborhood. Again, I don't mean to be Pollyanna. Many of your listeners live in places where the game is rigged. My only plea there is to say, this is an arena where you live, where you can actually re-rig the game.
You know, we should observe that the disaffection and doubt that is now so unsettling the United States of America is not occurring in a vacuum. Around the Western world, spurred mainly by immigration, authoritarianism and nationalism are on the rise. You talked about virus. Yeah. Is it a global contagion?
It is at once a global contagion. And at the same time, the thing that is unique about the way this plays out in the United States is that the United States bears a particularly distinct burden, actually, because I often put it this way. We in the United States are trying to become planet Earth's first mass multiracial democratic republic. There have been other societies in the history of human societies that that have tried one, two, or three of those marks, but no one has successfully hit all four. And it's hard. Especially hard where economically you have this undercurrent of both concentration of wealth and the increase of scarcity and anxiety and status anxiety. But I think what our exceptional burden and responsibility is right now is that the United States still, even in the midst of today's age of relative nativism, we still are the generator of the hybrids that the rest of the world needs. There are so many ways in which our responsibility right now to resist what I call purity thinking, purity of a bloodline, the purity of a folk, of a people, the purity of an ideology. That's what's spreading around the world. It's kind of because people feel, quote, contaminated by the other. We in America have a special responsibility to resist that call for purity and, in fact, to double down on our strength, which is hybridity and creating combinations and mongrelized mixes of ideas, thought, music, and humanity that the rest of the world needs.
When I was a kid, and maybe when you were too, civics and history were taught with a bit of a jingoistic flavor. Greatest country on earth, beacon to the world, shining city on a hill, the whole deal. It may not have been indoctrination exactly, but it was indoctrination-ish. Our curricula now are a little more forthright about things like the Trail of Tears and the Vietnam War and the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, slavery, you know, and that is great that we are reckoning more with the less inspiring part of our nation's history. But could we do maybe with a little more inculcation, you know, a reminder of our blessings, of our exceptionalism, if that really exists, would that be useful?
This is not a country defined only by enslavement, by the Trail of Tears, and by the displacement and genocide of Native peoples were not only defined by these points. And I think what a grown-up approach to civics would be able to do is to synthesize the thesis and the antithesis, to merge the good, the bad, and the ugly into a single story, and to recognize that undergirding that story is a set of ideas and promises that are not about exceptionalism in the sense of self-congratulation, much less jingoism. They're exceptional in the sense that they work an exceptional burden upon us that says the people in the government need to live up to this standard, these set of promises that were baked into the experiment from the beginning, and that every single decade, every single day that the country fails to live up to that set of baked-in promises is a day of shortcoming and failure and even betrayal. There is no such idea in other countries. We have that idea, and it is a great burden to us. And it's a creed that if you actually take it seriously, and I don't mean as an individual philosopher, I mean as a society, if we do in fact believe in equal justice under law, well, that's a great burden to deliver upon it. That means we're going to have to do a whole bunch of things, and that requires both understanding when we've gotten it right, how we persist in getting it wrong, and how the one can actually inform the remedy of the other. That is a full spectrum view of our history, of ourselves, and our civic inheritance and responsibility.
Eric, thank you so much.
Bob, thank you for having me in this conversation. I really, really enjoyed it.
Eric Liu is the co-founder and CEO of Citizen University and co-chair of the Commission on the Practice of Democratic Citizenship. Its report will be unveiled in May of 2020. On this holiday week, the Purple Project for Democracy is hosting the Great Thanksgiving Taking, asking young Americans to hijack the evening program to turn it away from arguments about politics toward thankfulness for our freedoms and reflection on where we're headed. Learn more at wethepurple.org.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.